There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
But Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. This show is all about President Trump's legal issues. They're complicated, and they bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and Twitter and whether it's finally actually RICO. It was clear we needed to devote some time each week to answering some of the biggest legal questions, so I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
It's not RICO, Josh, and also hello.
I haven't asked you the question yet, Ken. The format is I'm supposed to ask you if it's RICO, and at that point you can tell me that it's not RICO.
You asked rhetorically in the opener.
One of the newsy suggestions we are left with after Michael Cohen's purportedly soul-bearing testimony before the House Government Oversight Committee last week is that there are additional investigative matters related to the president being conducted by federal prosecutors in Manhattan, and that Cohen is not at liberty to discuss them because he's assisting in those investigations. Garrett Graff wrote an op-ed for the New York Times this week in which he argues this could be RICO. He says, quote, "Mr. Cohen's public testimony itself, where he certainly laid out enough evidence and breadcrumbs for prosecutors to verify his allegations, mentioned enough criminal activity to build a racketeering case. This has sparked many a cable news conversation about RICO." So, Ken, is this RICO? Could the Southern District of New York be building a Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act case against Donald Trump and the Trump Organization, and should they be doing so?
I think it's extremely implausible that they are. You know, we've talked about RICO before, Josh. It's a tool. It was built for taking down actual criminal organizations like the mafia and drug gangs and things like that. But it's a very unwieldy, clumsy tool. And the prosecutors have far better, more precise, smart bomb-type tools to go after things like anything the president may have done. RICO is mostly these days a sort of emotive tool. It's a way to signify how important or bad or horrific we think this conduct is. But real prosecutors use it very sparingly because it is so complicated, it is so difficult to plead in an indictment to prove, and it's just needlessly complicated. It's like a Rube Goldberg machine to jail somebody when they have much narrower and simpler ways to do it.
Well, so should we talk again about the elements of RICO? Because when you say it's not RICO, it's never RICO, this is like it's never lupus. And like on House, you know, they'd always say, oh, it might be lupus, and it was never lupus. But it's not literally never lupus. Sometimes it's lupus, and sometimes it's RICO. So what are, you know, RICO is more than just you did a bunch of repeated crimes and they involved some people you worked with. That's called conspiracy. It's different. You can charge that. What are the necessary elements for the government to be able to charge and prove a RICO case?
Well, they have to be able to show that there is an enterprise, which can't be one of the defendants. It has to be some sort of overarching enterprise, and that the people involved in the enterprise did at least two predicate acts that are a series of specified federal crimes, and that the purpose in the enterprise was for a criminal purpose. And then there's like a list of three or four others. The problem is, and we're seeing this now in the civil case accusing some of the Trump people of RICO, that it's extremely difficult to plead all these elements, let alone prove them. So, like you said, it's so much simpler to use conspiracy. It's fairly rare to have a situation where you can plausibly connect somebody to a criminal enterprise and not do so through a conspiracy charge and then hook them into everything being done that way. RICO is really designed for classic mafia-type structures where the street criminals are doing street crimes and the guys in the suits are removed multiple levels from it. But what we've seen in this case is repeatedly accusations that the president was sticking his thumb directly into things, whether it's paying Michael Cohen by check directly or, you know, giving direct instructions for things to be done or anything like that. Cohen's testimony before Congress suggested a far more traditional, simpler approach to things that could be done with conspiracy or aiding and abetting counts.
Yeah, so I think that's a key thing to emphasize about RICO. The reason the law was created and the reason that it's useful for things like the mafia is that, you know, there's not going to be an email from the mob boss that says, you know, do this drug transaction off this person. And so you need to be able to charge them for sort of heading this broad criminal enterprise because you can't charge them for the specific acts. But if you have piles and piles of financial statements and emails and tapes and other documents that have somebody directing a criminal act, then you don't need the big Rube Goldberg RICO charge because you can use simpler charges where you demonstrate their direct involvement in the criminal acts.
Exactly. Prosecutors would generally want to prove the simpler, more direct theory because it causes fewer problems. And you've seen that to some extent in the special counsel's indictments and also in the Southern District's indictment. They're as narrow and clean as they can be. And that's always just good practice when you're bringing indictments because you don't want to take on any burdens that you don't need to take on.
So what do we think the SDNY might be looking at if it's not RICO? What clues did we get from Michael Cohen's testimony about that? I mean, we've seen even before this testimony a lot of indications that they're interested in financial improprieties related to how Trump and his related entities, perhaps not just the business but also the foundation, paid, for example, for the campaign expense of hushing up Stormy Daniels.
Well, sure. There's all the campaign finance area, and it seems clear that the Southern District may be looking at the Trump organization, the Trump campaign, and all sorts of people who might have had a role in the hush money payments and possibly in other campaign activities. We also see now that the New York Attorney General is looking into insurance issues. So Cohen testified that the president, before he was president, would overvalue things for insurance purposes and commit fraud that way. And that would be a fairly classic type of thing that the federal prosecutors could go after, depending on who the statements were made to. And then you've got issues like bank fraud, because part of Cohen's testimony was that there was overvaluing or false statements about properties in various transactions. And that would be a classic federal prosecutor thing to go after in a bank fraud. But, you know, we don't see too much real action as opposed to talk. And I don't see anything that's consistent with the Southern District preparing some big sweeping, 100 defendant RICO case. I think they're going to continue to do the smart bombs.
And so if it's a narrower investigation around things involving the president and his businesses, is it likely that they'd be waiting for him to leave office in order to bring any of those indictments? I mean, they can't indict him while he's in office, but presumably there are related people or related entities who, if they believe those people or entities committed crimes, they don't have to wait for Trump to leave office.
Right. They don't have to wait for him to leave office. And in fact, it would be a problem for them to do so because there's statutes of limitations on everything. And though while you might have a plausible excuse for the statute not running while the president's in office, if he can't be indicted, you don't have that excuse for other people. So I suspect they would try to indict other people sooner. And they might, as people have speculated, wait to indict the president until he's out of office or possibly indict him and seal it or something like that. I mean, we're not really dealing with something that's ever been done before. It's fresh territory.
Let's talk a little bit about that bank fraud discussion. The allegation that Michael Cohen made in the hearing was that basically the president would adjust his claims of the valuations of his portfolios of assets based on what was convenient. If it was trying to value it for tax purposes, he wanted a low value. If it was trying to value it in order to get a loan, he wanted a high value. And my question here is, if there's a distinction here between factual claims and opinions of value for the purposes of a bank fraud crime. So, for example, if you tell a bank that you have $100 million in cash and you don't, that's obviously fraud. But if you tell a bank that your personal brand is worth $4 billion, which is one of the claims that Trump started making and allowed him to start claiming a bigger net worth than he was before. Can that be fraud? That feels like, you know, a pure matter of opinion or speculation or estimate. It seems to me it's up to the bank to decide what value, if any, they want to ascribe to your personal brand and deciding what kind of money to lend to you. I have trouble seeing how that could be a fraudulent statement since it's, you know, since it's so obviously a subjective statement.
Well, Josh, bank fraud is different than, say, defamation. We've talked about a lot about that line between fact and opinion and defamation law. In fraud, in criminal fraud, there's not quite that bright line. It's a question of proof in front of the jury. So, for instance, there's a federal false statements to banks statute that makes it a crime to make false statements willfully overvaluing any property or security to influence an institution. And it's up to the jury to determine whether opinions you offered, whether you knew that they were inflated and you deliberately gave them as inflated. And people have been prosecuted over appraisals and other things that could be construed to have an element of opinion. Now, you're not going to get prosecuted if it's a close call. If something is overvalued by 10% or something, that's not going to get you a federal criminal indictment. But if something is, you know, two, three times what it actually is, what any reasonable appraiser would appraise it at, that's when they're going to start looking and thinking that you willfully misled a bank.
So a lot of these are going to turn on fact questions, you know, what the, you know, what claims the president made when and how unreasonable they were. You saw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez starting to get at this on some of the insurance issues. But basically, there's going to have to be a lot more inquiry, both presumably by prosecutors out of our sight, that much of that inquiry may have already happened, and then also by Congress. And we have this big, long list from Jerry Nadler, who's the new Democratic chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, of people and entities that he is seeking information from. What do you make of this big list of, you know, 80 plus people and entities that he wants to talk to?
Right. So he sent out these 81 letters, and these are not yet subpoenas. They're the predecessor to that. It's awfully scattershot. I mean, I was surprised. I think it's even scattershot in a political and for show context. They went to everyone from members of the Trump Organization to the NRA to WikiLeaks to Julian Assange to places where they really have no expectation they're actually going to get a response. So it seems somewhat performative. And the subject matters that he's asking about are also very broadly described. So I think this is probably sort of a first shot that signaling the areas of interest. And if they want to be serious about it, when they get to the subpoena stage, they're going to need to narrow it considerably for it to have any effect.
Adam Schiff, who's the chairman of the Intelligence Committee in the House, has hired a veteran prosecutor to oversee his investigation, Daniel Goldman, who's a former assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. What do you make of this hire?
Well, it shows seriousness. I mean, Schiff himself is a former federal prosecutor. That suggests that he, at least for the Intelligence Committee, wants to take a methodical approach to it that won't interfere with the special counsel investigation and that will get things in an effective as opposed to cinematic way.
So Democrats are excited about what came out of this Cohen hearing. They feel like they have a lot of new things to look into. Republicans in the hearing were very dismissive of Michael Cohen and of his credibility. And subsequent to the hearing, a couple of senior Republicans on the committee, including Jim Jordan, who is the ranking Republican member in the minority, issued a letter to the Justice Department claiming that Michael Cohen had perjured himself and referring him for criminal prosecution. They had a number of claims. Cohen repeatedly said during the hearing that he never defrauded a bank. Of course, Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to bank fraud. They also allege that he perjured himself by claiming to have been a good lawyer, even though he was a bad lawyer. I'm going to read from the letter. It says, for instance, Mr. Cohen verbally testified that he was a good lawyer who understood the need to present his client with sound legal advice. Mr. Cohen contradicted his verbal testimony in his written statement by testifying that he made a payment to Stephanie Clifford, that's Stormy Daniels, quote, without bothering to consider whether that was improper, much less whether it was the right thing to do, unquote. So is that perjury? If you say
no.
You're a good lawyer when you're a bad lawyer?
No, that's closer to what you said before, a matter of opinion. And perjury is much harder to prove than fraud. The letter, it's as performative as the 81 letters going out. It's you know, it's posturing about how bad Cohen is. I don't think it should be taken very seriously.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we unfortunately will talk again about Roger Stone. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Before we get to Roger Stone, let's talk quickly about his frenemy and alleged co-conspirator, Jerome Corsi. Jerome Corsi, the conspiracy theorist who popularized the theory that Barack Obama was born outside the United States, apologized this week for promulgating another conspiracy theory, that murdered DNC employee Seth Rich and his brother Aaron had conspired to release the DNC emails rather than the Russians having done so. So, Ken, this apology statement from Jerome Corsi looks like it was written by a lawyer, and it doesn't look like it was written by the lawyer Larry Klayman.
No, it was not nearly crazy enough to be written by Larry Klayman. It does look like this is a negotiated apology statement in lieu of a lawsuit. We know that Seth Rich's family had sued Fox News and that they were pursuing legal claims against other people. The language of this strongly suggests that they eventually reached a pre-litigation deal with Corsi. And we don't know what other elements there might have been, whether any money changed hands. But this language is certainly not something that Corsi would do voluntarily. It doesn't resemble his normal rhetoric at all.
Roger Stone continues to refuse to not make news. Judge Amy Berman Jackson has issued yet another order for Stone to explain himself about his public statements. Stone had filed a motion for clarification with the court, asking how the gag order would impact the, quote, imminent publication of a paperback edition of his book with new content about how unfair all of these investigations are. But it turned out the new edition had already been published, and he'd never brought it up with the court before. So the judge now wants a bunch of information about Stone's dealings with his publisher and with social media so she can find out what he knew about what he was saying in what venues when. Ken, you think that this order from the judge does not bode well for Stone?
No, I think this strongly suggests that at the next hearing, he may be taken into custody. Judge Jackson is mad, and not just regular federal judge mad. I mean, really mad. And it's clear she thinks that she was misled at the last hearing when Stone's own lawyers suggested the terms of the broader gag order that she would issue in lieu of putting him in jail for the Instagram post that had allegedly crosshairs next to her. And she thinks that they were hiding the ball about this book. And on top of that, a so-called motion for clarification never goes well. Literally never in my entire career see a motion for clarification turn out well. The judge knows that you're just seeing either A, you got it wrong, dummy, or B, you idiot, you're totally unclear. And the judge reacts accordingly, and Judge Jackson did here. She said, I was perfectly clear. You suggested the terms. These are clearly under those terms. So now we're going to find out whether or not you lied to me and what you knew when you were hiding this from me at the last hearing.
You mentioned there Judge Jackson basically throwing at Roger Stone that his attorney suggested that she impose a gag order like this as a remedy. She also suggests that that forecloses any option that they would have to sue, claiming that the gag order is unconstitutional, that it unconstitutionally restricts his First Amendment right to speak about the case because it was his own idea that this gag order should be imposed on him. Is that right? Does that mean that we can't see a constitutional challenge about this?
It's certainly a strong argument that she's right that at the last hearing, Stone's lawyers were really working hard to keep him out of jail. It was clear that Judge Jackson interpreted the Instagram post as a threat or incitement about her. Stone's attorneys were scrambling to play defense, and I think they not unreasonably decided to trade a broad gag order to keep their client out of jail. So now, having even suggested the terms of the gag order, Judge Jackson is probably right that they can't turn around and say that that which they suggested was unconstitutional.
Besides the issue of the book publication, there's also the issue that Stone is still on social media, and he posted an Instagram story that said, "Who Framed Roger Stone?" It looked like a parody of a Who Framed Roger Rabbit poster. The Instagram story was seeking donations to Roger Stone's legal defense fund. So the gag order doesn't say that Stone can't talk about the case at all. It says he can assert his innocence. It says he can raise funds for his defense. So does Who Framed Roger Stone fall within that assertion of innocence exception?
And ironically, I'd say that Roger Stone is more cartoonish than Roger Rabbit. I think that it comes close to the line. So even though if that one Instagram post, which was taken down saying Who Framed Roger Stone, is not itself over the line, I think it's going to inform Judge Jackson's thinking when she's dealing with this book issue. So Stone has repeatedly, you know, run up as close to the line as he can, and that's going to hurt him when genuinely over the line things come up.
You know, the gag order says he can't make statements about the case. It doesn't say he can't ask questions. And when he says, "Who framed me?" he's just asking questions.
Yeah, and it doesn't say he can't use memes. So,
We are getting very near to the end of Paul Manafort's criminal prosecutions. He's going to be sentenced this Friday, not in Judge Jackson's court, but across the Potomac River before Judge T.S. Ellis in Virginia. Remember, Paul Manafort faced two separate criminal prosecutions at the same time. We talked over the last couple of weeks about the sentencing memos for that D.C. case before Judge Jackson, and now we've seen the memos for the Virginia case, and the theme seems pretty similar. Manafort is combative about how he's a good guy who's gotten a raw deal, and the special counsel is strongly condemning of Manafort and his actions, but does not recommend a specific sentence.
Right. And ironically, neither of the briefs really talks real numbers about the sentence. But looming over all of that is the fact that he was convicted of so many counts in Virginia that really the sky is the limit in terms of the sentence. I think Ellis is likely to see this as very defiant and not to react well. And, you know, bear in mind, all Judge Ellis has to do to not react well is to sentence Manafort within the guidelines, which is going to be up in the 15 to 20 year range. So I think that's more likely signaling to Fox News and signaling maybe to the president in a desperate bid for a pardon.
So we expect the sentencing on Friday, and then subsequently to that, Judge Jackson will get to issue her own sentence in the case before her. And the decision before her essentially will not be so much about the number of years as about whether she will tack on whatever year she sentences Manafort to on top of the Ellis sentence or allows them to run concurrently, in which case basically Judge Ellis's sentence will be the beginning and the end of the story about how long Paul Manafort is sent to prison.
Yes, and she has a 10-year cap in D.C., so the question will be how to impose that, because I suspect she'll go right up to the 10-year cap. If I were to bet on this again and lay down a marker like I did for Michael Cohen, I would guess that she's going to split it and make part of the sentence concurrent and part of the sentence consecutive. I'm going to take a stab at this, Josh, and say that I think Jackson is going to give him 5 years on top of whatever Ellis gives him.
And what do you think Ellis is going to give him?
I would be surprised if it's less than 10 years.
So we think we're looking at least 15 years, which means that he has to serve at least 13 years?
Exactly. In the federal system, you can get up to 15% off for good time, but that's it. There are a few other programs you can take advantage of sometimes to carve off a little time, and towards the end of their sentence, they'll step you down to a lower security like a halfway house. But he's looking at a very long time.
Finally, let's talk about what's next for the special counsel investigation now that one of the marquee prosecutions of that investigation is reaching an end. We have a new attorney general, William Barr. In his confirmation hearings, he wouldn't take a firm stand on whether he'd recuse himself from overseeing the Mueller investigation. Now he has decided not to recuse himself, he says, after discussion with, quote, senior ethics officials at the Justice Department. Was that a good decision to not recuse?
I think it was a plausible decision. So you remember that the issue for Barr was that earlier in this, he had sent completely gratuitously a memo basically criticizing the notion that the president could obstruct justice by firing the head of the FBI or by doing presidential tasks like that.
So I think we should say these are theories that the special counsel is thought to be pursuing. We don't know that these are his theories.
Exactly. It's theories that are bandied about in the media and that are attributed to him. Barr's criticism of those alleged theories is not beyond the pale. It's fairly mainstream in legal thought. if controversial politically. And sure, there's kind of an appearance that he injected himself into this, but I don't think it was completely out of bounds to say that this is obviously something he should recuse himself from. I do think that it will sort of forever follow him in any decision that he makes in this and put an asterisk next to it. So there's that. And, you know, he already has that by being handpicked, of course, by Trump.
I think it's important to remember about that Barr memo that it's, you know, it's fairly aggressive in its criticism, but it's also fairly narrow. It is about this matter of whether the president can use his official powers in order to obstruct justice. There's a wide variety of other things that the special counsel is looking into that are really completely unaddressed by that Barr memo.
It's true. And the memo itself is not overtly political. It does not read like something that one of Trump's own lawyers would write. It's somewhat pedantic. It's you know, intellectual, and you know, it's something that he might, if he didn't have the connections, have put in a blog post. So that's probably the thinking behind the Department of Justice ethics people, that it was not so over the line as to create the appearance of impropriety.
What should we be watching for to decide if Barr's oversight of the probe is satisfactory? I mean, I feel like this has been a problem from the outside, that there are certain things that if they happened, like if Mueller was fired, we would know that. But there are other things that that the special counsel might be seeking approval to do that we don't know about those requests. We don't know if they're being approved or denied, and we don't know whether those approvals or denials are reasonable.
Well, if we see new indictments, then we'll be able to infer that Barr didn't stop them, and that will give us some information. If we see whatever the much-prophesied special counsel report is, and if that some portion of it gets out, then we'll again see what was or wasn't stopped. But otherwise, a lot of this, as is normal in a federal case, the supervisory functions are going to go on in secret, as they usually do.
Finally, you mentioned the Mueller report and whether we're going to see it and whether we're going to see it in close to its entirety. I think a lot of that speculation is derived from an expectation that the report is imminent, which I am not so sure about. But James Comey, remember James Comey? He has a new op-ed urging that the report should be disclosed in close to in full. And his argument is basically about how, you know, usually the Justice Department does not give a full accounting of things that it didn't indict in an investigation because that's unfair to the people who were investigated and not indicted. It's not really any of the public's business, except in certain high-profile cases, like with the Michael Brown shooting in Missouri, like with the IRS scandal, where something has been so widely discussed and it has caused a certain amount of distrust in law enforcement institutions, sometimes there's a public need to give a full accounting of what was investigated and not indicted. And he's saying that this is one of those cases.
Right. He says it's basically one of the rare cases where it's essential to the institutional credibility and oversight. And I certainly think that if there is such a category, that this would have to fit into it. So I think it's a strong argument. I'm not sure I would have chosen Comey, who is in the mix in all this, to make it. But I think he's right that in this case, the normal interests in keeping everything private are overridden. I mean, from the start of this, we've seen signs of the Justice Department following that rule by doing things like saying individual one in an indictment, even though everyone knows that means Donald Trump. You know, that's a reflection of traditional Department of Justice policy of not naming people who aren't charged in the indictment. But in a case like this, where a lot of the facts are known and where it's highly known and speculated about who is suspected, I think most of the institutional reasons for not disclosing the facts of the investigation fall away.
There is so much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW, and you can also find us on Facebook. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.